I cannot think of a better thing we could do with this money than deliver it directly to the people that we know that are involved with trying to heat their homes.
Lawmakers override Sarah Palin's stimulus veto. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 10th of August. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, protesters make their views known.
When was the last time we ever had anything from the federal government we could believe?
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Guess who teens say is their most important influence when it comes to sex? Their parents. Listen up. Teens want to know what you think, even if they don't act like it. Talk with your teens about sex, love, and values. Nationwide, one out of every three girls gets pregnant at least once by age 20. Make sure your daughter isn't one of them. Visit stayteen.org for special parent tips and more information on how you can prevent teen pregnancy. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
State lawmakers met for less than 7 hours today in special session in Anchorage. The morning began with the confirmation vote for Commissioner of Military and Veterans Affairs, Lieutenant General Craig Campbell, to become Lieutenant Governor. Before the vote, he was questioned by Republican Senator Linda Menard, who chaired the State Affairs Committee meeting. Menard asked how he would proceed if he were required to take over as governor.
What do you intend to do to prepare for the next step, should you have to step in as governor?
Madam Chair, that would be a very interesting step to take, because the law would require that my first action be to declare an election to elect a governor, because I would be a non-elected governor. And as the Constitution and the statutes require, we can't have that. In this role, as a non-elected lieutenant governor for an elected individual, Sean Parnell, who was elected as lieutenant governor moving to governor, he can hold that role. I couldn't. So my real steps would be in preparing to make sure I know through my job as lieutenant governor on the elections, running division of elections, and what we're doing on the election process to make sure we legally declare the next election to elect who the next governor would be.
Although Campbell's confirmation passed on a 55-4 vote, there was some opposition to his taking the lieutenant governor position. Robert Goodman was opposed to Campbell, expressing dissatisfaction with his handling of the Alaska Territorial Guard members' retirement pay.
General Campbell has been deceitful and deceptive and has shown a complete lack of integrity when dealing with me concerning the ATG issue. Now, when the person at the top lacks integrity, it affects the whole organization working that project. And in this case, it is filtered into the Department of Administrative Retirement Sector and the Department of Law because their reaction to my request for ruling concerning State of Alaska military pay.
At 1 p.m., the legislature took up the issue of former Governor Sarah Palin's veto of $28 million in energy stimulus dollars. Palin said that she rejected the money because she felt there were strings attached that would impose federal building codes on Alaska. A recent letter from the Department of Energy sought to reassure legislators that that was not the case, but some lawmakers were not convinced. A packed room listened as numerous senators and representatives took turns speaking in favor or against accepting the $28 million. Wasilla Republican Representative Carl Gatto planned to vote for the override. Gatto said the state had already accepted a substantial amount of stimulus money that was offered, and this was a small piece.
An awful lot of the federal stimulus money went to big car companies, lending companies, banks, bonuses. This money goes right to home energy rebate programs, home weatherization programs, and some loan programs. I cannot think of a better thing we could do with this money than deliver it directly to the people that we know that are involved with trying to heat their homes and cook and other things that are important.
Democrat Senator Lyman Hoffman from Bethel said Alaska should have been the first state to accept the funds, not the last.
We live in the coldest climate state in the union, and we should be setting the standard in efficiencies and the way energy is being utilized throughout the state. This summer, many of you spent hours and hours traveling to far reaches of Alaska, talking to Alaskans, and I'm waiting with anticipation the reports that come back that are going to ask this legislature to pony up to continue to address the energy needs of Alaska.
But North Pole Republican Representative John Coghill, who chairs the House Rules Committee, said he was convinced that the money would in fact require new building codes.
And so the argument over this $28 million really centers around whether do we want to be the masters of our own coding and do our own local investment and state control, or do we surrender it to the feds? And it's coming at us. It's going to come pretty fast. We're going to have some defense. So I think we should reject this.
And Anchorage Republican Bob Lynn said he wasn't convinced by the letter from the Department of Energy that there would not be strings attached to the stimulus funds.
Just a casual reading, even, of ARR Section 410, that looks like strings to me, if not strings, perhaps even ropes on this process. You know, we build very good houses up here in Alaska. We build good buildings. We have excellent engineers. We have an outstanding construction industry. And I think we can figure out our own building codes, thank you. And I want to send a message to Nancy Pelosi and the other busybodies in Washington, D.C. to keep their pea-picking hands off of how we do things here in Alaska. We'll figure it out on our own.
The veto override did prevail on a vote of 45 in support of the override, 14 opposed, and 1 excused. Governor Sean Parnell has sent a letter to the federal government saying he will accept the funds. Lawmakers turned down one further attempt to override the vetoes from last year's budget just a few minutes before adjournment. Senate Finance Co-Chair Lyman Hoffman asked for support of other projects that were in this year's capital budget but had been rejected by former Governor Sarah Palin. They included court system improvements and 4 harbor projects in southeast Alaska. The vetoes involved $10.2 million. In a voice vote, the override failed by 5 votes, getting the support of only 40 members. Lawmakers arriving in downtown Anchorage for their special session were greeted by demonstrators wearing green hard hats, urging them to vote to override the governor's veto of federal energy funds. Later in the day, demonstrators lined the same streets, urging them not to. But that was only part of the action in the streets today. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
It was a day for bullhorns, signs, and sunscreen. On one of the most beautiful days of the year, Alaskans were all over the streets for their causes. A 10 o'clock tea party waved signs protesting government spending. A number of the protesters wore buttons reading Palin 2012. Sue Easterly of Anchorage was waving a giant pair of panties and saying the government is too big for its britches. She doesn't believe for a moment that there are no strings attached to the federal stimulus money.
Except, you see that sign right there with the strings attached? Exactly. There'll be strings attached. They might say there's no strings attached, but when was the last time we ever had anything from the federal government we could believe?
But that was one of no less than 5 demonstrations that took place downtown. And some of the demonstrators would move from one to another, seeking to make their points. A lot of it was about the health care reform effort pending in Congress. Organizing for America held a press conference in front of the offices of the congressional delegation featuring people who are having trouble with the nation's health care system. They were surrounded by hecklers from the Tea Party who interjected comments as they tried to speak. Anchorage business owner Lisa Rogers took the high road and stuck to her point.
Our country needs health care reform. Our country's health care system needs a complete overhaul. I know Senator Begich is going to the Chamber of Commerce luncheon. As a chamber member, I plan on joining him there. I want him and Senator Murkowski and Congressman Young to know that small business owners like me want them to vote for health insurance reform. Thank you.
Wearing a gun owner t-shirt, George Hines, the loudest of the hecklers, said it was really the unions that were pushing health care reform, and the public was on to them now and not about to put up with it.
We're sick of the people with money determining what goes on in our country. The people are sick of it. They're stepping up, and we all know what we see on TV. This isn't a bunch of insurance agents pushing us out here. This is a bunch of people that have heard the word what's going on and they've had enough. We're fixing this. We're going to fix it every day until it's done. Until Obama's gone or he starts doing the right thing for us.
A few blocks away at the Chamber of Commerce, the demonstration was more restrained. The lunches sold out. People supporting health care reform quietly lined the walls. Beth Elliott was there with a baby.
I think that we need health care reform. I guess, yeah, I do believe there's a chance that we won't get it. So if I can do a little bit to try to encourage it, then I will.
And meanwhile, another chant was building up by the Performing Arts Center. These were people protesting the federal moratorium on Medicaid care, many of them disabled and now stuck in the system or frozen out of it until the state and federal governments come to terms. Gwen Lee of the Arc of Anchorage said their group had messages for both the state and federal governments.
People with disabilities are caught in between. We're the ones that are suffering. Federal government, lift that moratorium. State, do what you need to support the Department of Health and Social Services to get their ducks in a row. Meanwhile, people are waiting for a life in the community. They're waiting to get out of the hospital. They don't want to go to nursing homes. We're in the middle.
It could take weeks to even months for the rest of the Medicare and Medicaid waiver moratorium to be lifted. As for health care reform, Begich gave a stirring speech in favor of it, but does not yet have to commit himself on the most controversial points. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a push for more recognition for Alaska's tribes.
There is now a need for this. This is not an option anymore. We need the federal government to stand up, exercise your trust authority.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Penn Air, providing scheduled service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations online at pennair.com.
Shell has submitted a plan to drill in two areas of the Beaufort Sea off Alaska's coast. Now the Minerals Management Service has 30 days to evaluate and analyze Shell's proposal. Today, MMS announced Shell's applications are complete, meaning the company's paperwork is in order. Now, over the next month, MMS will prepare an environmental assessment and do a technical review. MMS spokesman Nicholas Pardee says his agency will decide whether to let Shell move forward.
We have basically a 30-day window, according to the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act, to act on it. So we can either approve it, we can disapprove it, or we can require modifications to the exploration plan. You know, we're far from actually seeing any action on this. There's a lot of environmental review and coordination with other agencies that needs to happen first.
Pardee says in addition to the environmental assessment, which will look at possible impacts, Shell's plan must meet requirements of the Environmental Protection Agency and the state of Alaska. Pardee says Shell's plan has been sent to the governor's office, state and federal agencies, local borough governments, Alaska Native stakeholders, and various groups, including the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission. They have 21 days from today to weigh in. Pardee says other members of the public can also give their input. Shell wants to drill in two locations, both 16 to 23 miles north of Point Thompson. The company would use one drill ship and an ice management vessel, which would drill two wells over a year. Shell got the leases during sales in 2005 and 2007. They were not affected by a recent court decision to reevaluate the current leasing program since they were part of an earlier plan. Offshore drilling is controversial in Alaska. Some Alaska Native groups fear any spill or disturbance could pollute waters critical for marine mammals, which are a major part of the Inupiaq diet. Environmentalists warn there is not a proven plan to clean up spilled oil in icy waters. MMS estimates that the Beaufort Sea contains more than 8 billion barrels of oil and 27 trillion cubic feet of natural gas. tribal sovereignty was the main subject when the head of the Bureau of Indian Affairs traveled to rural Alaska last Friday. Larry Echohawk is the Assistant Secretary of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Echohawk heard testimony from tribal leaders throughout the state during his visit to Bethel and the surrounding villages. Shane Iverson from member station KYUK reports.
Native leaders from around the state are saying that the presidency of Barack Obama offers the best chance in recent history to improve relations with the federal government. Obama selected an attorney and professor of federal Indian law to run the Bureau of Indian Affairs. That's Larry Echohawk. During his public meeting in Bethel, tribal representative urged the federal government to assert their authority. Nelson Ngapuk of Tuntutuliak spoke before Echohawk at the meeting.
It is our hope that President Obama will issue an executive order reaffirming the government-to-government relationship between the United States government and the tribes across this nation.
Several tribal leaders said that the state of Alaska is ignoring tribal sovereignty. Issues like wildlife management, law and order, and child custody are all the jurisdiction of the state, in large part because tribes in Alaska often have no land and thus no jurisdiction of their own. Dan Winkleman spoke as a member of the Shagluk IRA. Winkleman is an attorney. He said living conditions are continuing to erode in rural Alaska, but the Obama administration can help the tribes. He asked that Echohawk push the Interior Department to change a regulation which prohibits Alaska tribes from placing their lands under trust with the federal government.
There is now a need for this. This is not an option anymore. We need the federal government to stand up, exercise your trust authority.
For many, the root of the problem lies in ANCSA. The act signed in 1971 was an attempt to settle native land claims in the state and clear a path for the oil pipeline. Rather than put lands in the hands of tribes, ANCSA gave native ownership to village and regional corporations. That left tribal governments without any jurisdiction. Harold Napoleon, originally of Paiute, used this comparison to describe the present situation.
It's as if we were allowing the casinos in the lower 48 to determine policy for the tribes that own them. That is a set of unnatural circumstances that ANCSA created up here.
After the meeting, Echohawk piled into a boat with tribal leaders from across the state. They went on a tour of three Kuskokwim villages. Their first stop was the village of Akachok. Mike Williams Sr. was the host. He's an Iditarod racer and co-chairman of the Alaska Intertribal Council. As they walk the village, Williams stops at a metal bin on a corner of a dirt road. The bin stands about waist high. Williams explains to Echohawk and his aide, Wheezy Garriott, that this bin is actually a receiver for human waste. Families dump it in using 5-gallon buckets.
Doesn't it leach into everything?
Yep, it leaches in here and it just contaminates everything.
And it's brought into the homes.
Yep, it's brought into the homes. So this is, many of the communities cannot afford or are still working on their pipe systems. It's tougher.
Well, this is why Wheezy and I needed to come here and see this.
Echohawk says he's not announcing any major regulation changes at this point, but as he walked back to the boat, he says a restoration of tribal sovereignty might be the big change that's needed.
The Alaskan Natives have suffered because much of their sovereignty has been removed from them. They do not have the ability, like many other tribes across the United States have, to control their own destiny.
The issue of tribal sovereignty for Alaska tribes could come up again at the National Tribal Summit hosted by President Obama this October. I'm Shane Iverson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, on the web at grantstation.com, serving Alaskan organizations for over 10 years. And by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
The cleanup and salvage of the fishing vessel, the Icy Mist, is almost complete. The 58-foot boat went aground on Akutan Island on February 25th. Dan Magone and his crew immediately set to work removing all of the oils and pollutants from the vessel. The crew was taken to the island and left on a cliff above the rocky beach where the boat was grounded. On each of 4 days, they climbed down the cliff to remove the pollutants. Then the project had to be set aside for multiple months while the Magone team cleaned up the Margun, which went aground on St. George. Dan Magone says there was only one major issue with letting the icy mist wait.
But the only thing everybody was worried about was there was still 135,000 pounds of codfish on the icy mist, and so nobody was looking forward to the mess that was going to be when we got back.
When Magone went back to the icy mist in July, a storm had broken a hole in the fish holds, washed all of the cod away, and left boulders in their place.
In the meantime, the storms had basically torn the bottom of the boat out, and so we had great big boulders. We had one that was about 8 feet in diameter that was up in the middle of the main fish hold, and a smaller one that was stuck up in the number two fish hold. And there was no longer a main engine in the engine room anymore, and it was replaced by a great big boulder.
The crew blasted away the boulders in order to tow away the wreck and filled in many of the spaces with foam so they wouldn't fill with water when moving the vessel. Though the icy mist is relatively small, the boulder-filled beach made it difficult to pull off. On their first attempt, the line attaching the wreck to the tug snapped back with so much force it broke some of the gear. Magone rented another tug and eventually got the boat off of the beach. As they dragged it to Unalaska, it flipped over in the middle of the night and slowed down the trip. Once in Dutch Harbor, Magone's team turned the boat over in order to put explosives inside of it.
We just blow holes in tanks that are full of air so that we know that it will sink rapidly and it'll go straight down.
Magone will tow the boat to an area 33 miles northwest of Unalaska early this week where the water is 1,000 fathoms deep. There they will detonate the explosives so the ship sinks to the bottom in an area where it will not affect any other boats. Nothing on the boat was salvageable, but they did remove many smaller pieces and electronics.
Because you can't have loose debris because you don't want a bunch of junk floating on the water when this thing sinks. So, you know, you have to get all that stuff off, whether it's any good or not, you know.
Magone estimates that the Icy Mists insurance company will have to pay about $400,000 for the salvage work because of the difficulty in accessing the boat next to a cliff. Federal law requires wrecks to be removed instead of letting them deteriorate and create marine debris. The number of deaths this year on the Seward Highway between Potter Marsh to Girdwood produced a standing room only crowd at the Girdwood Community Building Friday night. As KSKA's Len Anderson reports, the 3-hour meeting revolved around engineering, education, and enforcement.
Since 1977, nearly 100 people have died on the approximately 35-mile, heavily used stretch of highway. The annual fatality totals vary, but 2009 is proving to be one of the more fatal years. 6 have died since May, including 2 killed last week. The community meeting was called a couple of weeks ago by Girdwood Fire Chief William Chadwick to examine causes and find possible solutions. Ron Martindale of the State Department of Transportation said, despite popular opinion, unsafe passing is not a major cause of fatal and serious injury accidents.
Crashes that mean occur while someone is passing are actually less than 10% of the fatal and major injury crashes on the Seward Highway corridor, but they do get a lot of attention.
Martindale is DOT's Highway Safety Improvement Program Coordinator. He said whether speaking of the entire highway between Seward and Anchorage or just the Girdwood-Anchorage section, other causes far outweigh passing.
Unsafe speed is 37% of the fatals and 33% of the major injuries. Site unsafe speed is a factor in the corridor. And aggressive driving, 50% of the fatals and roughly 47% of the major injuries.
Drowsiness can also be a factor, but less on the Girdwood to Anchorage portion than from Girdwood to Seward. Other DOT speakers described mitigation efforts already completed, underway, or planned. Those included center rumble strips, more warning and information signs beyond the federal requirements, plus road repair and improvements, as well as more public service announcements, beginning with a campaign against drowsy drivers. Mike Hawker, who represents the district in the state legislature, cited education, possibly along with tougher penalties, as two important responses to the fatal accident trend. Several members of the public, like Jim Dupkin, voiced disapproval over a major improvement that DOT had made.
The three-lane thing is bad, and I think in the wintertime you never know which way the lane really goes. In the wintertime it can be very difficult determining who has the right of way to that center lane.
Other public suggestions? Better advanced signage for the turnouts and more turnouts. Photo radar, improved reflective markings, and Elsie Yeager's suggestion to paint chevrons on portions of the highway.
In Japan, in one bad place, they had a 40% crash reduction. In Wisconsin, they had the average driver going 14 miles an hour slower.
Another popular suggestion was expanding the highway to four lanes. DOT responded, with support from Valdez Representative John Harris, the $600 million initial estimate for the difficult terrain made the proposal too expensive. For example, a four-lane expansion on the Parks Highway carries a much smaller $100 million price tag. Adding to the challenge, federal funding support for Alaska highway construction is declining. Several people suggested concrete medians known as Jersey barriers between the two lanes to prevent passing. DOT noted, while the barriers reduce passing accidents, it comes at the cost of increasing other difficulties for drivers. Enforcement proved popular, and the troopers urged people with cell phones to call 911 when spotting reckless driving, provided people are willing to testify later in court. As for more troopers, Colonel Audie Holloway said that wish was being realized.
The point I want to make is that we're doing a lot with what we have, and we are getting to the point where we're going to have all our positions filled, which should make some difference. And you should be able to see that difference on the highway. In the meantime, what we've done is, like I said, reallocated resources toward being visible, more visible on the highway.
Holloway said AST's new Bureau of Highway Patrol uses personnel from other posts, works with local law enforcement, and has special enforcement campaigns. He said of 50 new troopers, 28 were receiving field training, while 15 were still at the academy. This is Len Anderson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Shane Iverson in Bethel, Ann Hillman in Unalaska, and Len Anderson in Anchorage. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau, and Steve Heimel and Ellen Lockyer from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Gooseberry Peter. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
And by
Alaska Communication Systems. ACS offers high-capacity, high-speed bandwidth for business with speeds up to Gig E, connecting companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.